I'm doing this lecture to help you out sometimes with some of the questions that beginning harmony students sometimes have about learning the rules of harmony and voice leading. I think a lot of beginning harmony students sometimes feel as though learning harmony is nothing more than a long list of rules about things that they can't do. It's a bunch of stuff that seems to crimp your creativity or make you kowtow to a bunch of sort of silly things that don't really matter. That's a perfectly understandable way of thinking about it, because a lot of the rules of voice leading, all those things about chord construction and avoiding parallel fifths and octaves and hidden octaves and octaves by contrary motion and not doubling your leading tone and so on, all of that is there for a perfectly good reason. A lot of perfectly good reasons, as a matter of fact. But right at first, it might not be immediately obvious what those reasons are. So I'd like to take you through and explain to you why some of them are the way they are. I think the most important thing to realize from the get-go about voice leading and chord construction rules is that these are the accumulated experience of many, many generations of composers. In other words, they're not so much rules as they are practices that you can follow for the best results. Now, to understand what some of those results are, we need to go back to some very, very basic, I think really downright elementary concepts in music, but they're important for you to understand. The first of those is to understand what a pitch that we hear actually is. So let's begin. I'm going to play for you just a little group of a few notes up and down, and we will listen to those. Now, what you were just hearing is one of the simplest kinds of sounds possible. That's just a plain sine wave. In other words, it is just the pure frequencies of those notes, F, G, A, B flat, A, G, F. Just the pure frequencies. If you were to see those on an oscilloscope, it would be just a plain wavy line. Now, I'm going to play this again, but you're going to notice something, I think, about the sound that you hear. That sound, you will notice right away, I think, that sound has changed somewhat. It may not be immediately obvious what the change was, but I think it was pretty clear, wasn't it, that the sound of that was quite a bit more interesting than the one you heard before. The sound had quite a bit much more character. Just listen to it again. The reason that sound is so much more interesting is because it isn't just a single wave now. There's a second wave going along, and as a matter of fact, that wave is exactly twice the frequency, two times the frequency of the original. That means that what you're hearing is very subtly above the main note, you're hearing a note an octave higher. Let me play that for you with just that second wave alone. As you can hear, that second wave is a lot quieter than the original one, but it's being heard right along with the original wave, and therefore the sound that comes out is like this. So in effect, you're actually hearing octaves, so you're playing octaves on the piano. It's just that that upper octave, what we call the second partial, that upper octave is a lot quieter than the main octaves, so therefore it adds color to the note. We don't really hear it as an octave per se, at least not that easily. Now I want you to listen to this. Now that sound is even more interesting than the previous ones, although the difference this time is somewhat more subtle. It's not as obvious as the change from the plain sine wave to the note with the second partial. That's because I've added a third partial. Now that third partial is one octave plus a fifth above the main note. So for example, if the main note is F, the first note is F, then the note on the third partial is C, an octave up. Here it is all by itself. So I think you can hear it's much, much quieter, of course. You don't really hear it as a fifth above. You can't really make it out so much as a discrete pitch. What it does is it simply makes an originally colorless tone considerably more colorful. So here's that wave again with the fundamental and the second and third partials. Now it's precisely that quality of music, the fact that notes have partials, and all of them do. Human voice, violins, pianos, whatever. They all have those partials that account for certain acoustic phenomena. You'll notice that when a note is being played along with its partials, like its second or third partial, that you don't really hear those partials as separate tones. You hear them as being part of the main tone that you're hearing. When you're writing harmony in a four-voice texture, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, if, when moving from one chord to another, if a pair of voices, say the soprano and bass together, or the soprano and tenor together, or any two voices, if those two voices enter into a relationship that puts them as though you had a fundamental and one of those close overtones or close partials. Let's say, for example, the two notes are moving, the soprano, say, and the bass are moving in parallel octaves like that, in octaves. The ear has a tendency to hear those, therefore, not as two separate voices, but as one only. And that's one of the main reasons behind these kinds of prohibitions, in that what happens is that acoustic phenomena step in, and they really mess up the way we're hearing our harmony. The three voices we're supposed to be hearing suddenly become two, or the four voices become three, simply because the acoustic phenomena have served to close off two notes and make them into one. Now that's a lot of words, so let me explain this a little more easily, all right? We're going to start out just by listening to two voices together playing in thirds. Certainly no one would have any problem hearing those as two separate lines. They're moving in parallel tenths, which are just thirds, and you can hear them as being very, very separate. Now let's hear what happens if they move together in octaves. I think you can hear that the individuality of the two voices is considerably masked. Because they're moving in octaves like that, the upper voice really almost sounds decorative to the lower voice. It just sounds like that second partial above it. So as a result, instead of two really discrete voices, we're hearing a single voice with a kind of a decorative aspect to the other voice. If you were to hear this in the middle of a texture, all of a sudden it would sound a little bit like a hole had appeared in the musical fabric. That's why we don't want to write parallel octaves. It's purely acoustic. For that same reason, we also avoid octaves when they're not actually parallel, but the result of contrary motion. That is, for example, the two voices in question are moving in opposite motions, to be sure, but each one is an octave apart. Say, at one point they're an octave apart, and the next point they're two octaves apart. That's still parallel octaves because the ear still tends to hear it as a single voice instead of two. Let me give you an example. In this particular example, what's happening is that there is a direct parallel octave in the outer voices from the first to second chord. You might want to hear that again. So in effect, it tends to sound a little bit, really, as though what you're hearing are three voices and not four, because there's that parallel octave. Now here's what happens if it becomes an octave by contrary motion instead of actually parallel. The overall effect is pretty much the same. There's that same sense of the disappearance of one of the voices. It still sounds more like three voices instead of four. So for that reason, we forbid the use of octaves in contrary motion or fifths in contrary motion. Remember, the fifth is the third partial above the note. Other than that, contraries are fine. Fourths, thirds, sixths, they're all fine. But those particular ones, the octaves and the fifths, are a problem. And by the way, I should mention, remember that a unison is an octave, really, when you get down to it. It really is. So moving from a unison in one voice to an octave next beat is not correct. Now, possibly one of the tougher ones to understand is what we call a direct or hidden octave, or fifth. This is a little more subtle, and as a matter of fact, theorists are divided on whether or not we should even worry about it. Bach worried about this only when it occurred between the outer voices, that is, the soprano and the bass, and only when the soprano was leaping. His idea here is that a soprano leap will tend to draw the ear's attention towards that leap, and therefore we might hear the problem. Let's begin by hearing an obvious voice-leading error. That one was pretty easy to hear. What it was is that the outer voices were moving in parallel octaves. And just to make matters worse, those outer voices were moving from the leading tone right to the tonic. It's really pretty bad. Listen to it again. Now, right now the soprano is not leaping. But what if we were to put a little leap in there? That is, move up from the fifth of the scale to the seventh of the scale in the soprano. From five to set, and then one. When the soprano reaches set in this thing, a scale degree seven, it will be then a parallel octave moving into the next beat. Listen to this. So you see, it doesn't start out with a problem, but then when we move to the middle of the measure, five, set, one, what we wind up hearing is a particularly bad parallel octave. Now, the reasoning behind a hidden octave in this case is, what if you did not move to seven in the soprano, but you just jumped right up to one? Is it possible that the ear would tend to fill that space in during the leap with the notes that would make for that parallel octave anyway? You listen. This is what is called a hidden or direct octave in this case. It is not a practice you would ever find in Sebastian Bach's music. He would avoid it very carefully, occurring as it is in the outer voices with the soprano leaping. Hear it again. You know, even if you don't hear the potential parallel octave in it, you do hear that there's a certain abruptness to the way it winds up moving. There's something a little bit unpleasant. Hidden fifths and octaves are not good to write unless you really can't help it, and you really should avoid it in a situation like this. Avoid them completely when the soprano moves by leap and when it's in the outer voices. Between other voices, it's not as big of an issue, but you should always try to be sensitive to it. nonetheless. Now, another thing you might need to remember about is what can happen if you accidentally double your leading tone. Doubling the leading tone is generally not a good idea because it's a very strong note. Doubling the leading tone also has a tendency to produce parallel octaves because that doubled leading tone needs to resolve, and that leading tone is resolving upward. Generally speaking, it's not a good thing to do. Here's an example. If you were following along, I'm sure you heard the way that C sharp in there, that was the leading tone, the way it suddenly popped out of the texture. This is what happens when you double your leading tone. The doggone thing kind of tends to pop up out of the texture and therefore will distract our listener. One last thing to remind you about, and that is that if you are in minor keys, such as that last example, you've got to remember to raise your leading tones. Provided you're using them as a leading tone, you've got to remember to do that. Otherwise, what you wind up with is kind of neat sounding in a way, but it's not 18th century harmony. What you wind up with is typically modal, maybe Dorian mode or something like that, and it comes out sounding a little bit Renaissance-y. Here's an example. Yeah, it's not bad or something like that, but it doesn't quite sound like something you might hear from, say, Bach or Mozart or any other composer of that time. We need, of course, to hear it like this. So let's finish up this talk with a little discussion then of just a bad progression. I'm going to play for you a progression that contains a couple of errors, and we'll talk about how to fix those. You'll want to hear that again, but just listen, there are a couple of really pretty good-sized errors in it. So listen again. The first of those errors has to do with motion from third to fourth chord. What happens is that having reached the supertonic in this key, we're in F major and we reached a G major triad, we then move directly downward to an F major triad, that is the tonic, with everybody moving in the same direction. The result is not only a parallel octave, but a parallel fifth in moving from that chord, of one chord to another. It's quite jarring. Listen for that this time. Now listen from here, right there. That sudden motion like that, it just sounds very poor at that point. Now, there's a second mistake here in addition to all those parallels, and that is that G minor chord is, after all, a predominant. It's a predominant chord. It prepares the dominant, and it is being sent, and not to the dominant as it should be, but directly to the tonic. So in other words, the chord is being misused, and this is the equivalent of bad grammar. In English, as though you're not using good grammar, say your subjects and verbs don't agree or something like that. And as a result, the whole thing comes across sounding just amateurish. This is not professional writing. It has a poor and a labored sound to it. So I intend to repair it by doing a couple of things. The first thing I'm going to do is have my supertonic chord move directly to the dominant, as it should. And by doing so, I can also get rid of all those parallels, since I won't be moving back to the tonic. Here is my solution. You can hear it's a little shorter. It's actually one chord shorter than the old one. But now there's a grammar. From 1 to 1/6 to 2 to 5/7 to 1. One last time. 1/6, 2, 5/7, and 1. This actually brings up a final point I want to make, is that sometimes bad voice leading may also be reflecting a poor chord progression. So poor choice of chords, ungrammatical chords, can also result in ungrammatical voice leading. Sometimes the two tend to come together. So I hope this short talk has helped you to understand a little bit why the rules are the way they are. Is that if you follow them, if you follow the rules, you have a chance of writing a reasonably smooth and professional sounding progression. And if you don't follow them, you may get something that's expressive or interesting, but you may also wind up sounding like a hopeless amateur. Use the expertise of those who have come before you. Follow the advice and learn how to write a good progression. Also, learn how, as much as you can, to listen to progressions when they aren't good so you can figure out what's wrong with them. That's all for now.